I'm in Palmerston talking to Hugh O'Connor. Hugh, lovely old line of houses here in Mill Lane. How old is your house?
I don't really know how old it is, but it was bought by Edward Cecil Guinness in 1885. I have a record of that somewhere, and the whole row of houses were bought by Guinness. He became the first Lord Ivy. Ivar. Oh yes, mustn't be Ivy. Ivar.
And the houses were mill houses, were they? I mean, they were for the millers originally, weren't they?
Yes, they were. And this was the row of eight. Now the four lower ones were built by Crampton's about 100 years ago. The original double gabled houses on the site were knocked down, and there was a man lived here who remembered it as a vacant site. He told me that he remembered as a child that the site was vacant. They had knocked down the older houses, and then Crampton built the present small cottages. These ones here are very old. This was bigger. There was an extension to the towards the west there, quite large. It shows on the older maps, but there's traces of it out there. I found traces when I was building the shed. I found a wall, in fact, which served me very well for my shed. I just extended it upwards.
How long are the O'Connors here?
Well, we have lived here. I've lived here all my life, but not in this house. I lived first, there's a house up at the corner, the old inn, and we lived there. When I was three, we came down to number four of the small cottages. And then a few years after I was married, well, it's 30, we're 35, 36 years in this house.
Imagine that long, yeah.
Now, my wife was born in number four above the old inn.
Yes.
And I married her, and my brother married her sister.
And what kind of background do you come from, Hugh? What was your father doing for a living?
He worked on the family estate for Guinness. He drove a horse and cart. He came from up from Wexford, and my mother came from the north. She came from Guildford in the County Down, and they met in Inchicore.
What was his job working for Guinness's
Well, it's
on the estate?
general, a farm labourer, you know, and he drove the horse and cart, and he looked after the horses. Every weekend we used to go up when we were kids with him to feed the horses on a Sunday, you know, Saturday, Sunday. Well, it was after dinner Saturday and Sunday. We'd go up there and feed the horses.
What was Lord Ivor like?
Lord
Was
Ivy.
Ivy, sorry, but
Ivy.
again, what was Lord Ivy like?
Well, we just saw him, you know, this figure would go by and everybody would be your lordship, you know. But we just see them from a distance, you know. We have a picture of him somewhere too.
I know, yeah. But as a man, was he jolly? Was
Oh
he?
yes, yeah. All the works were very, you know, quite content. They used to go up. If there was a big affair at the house, they'd be all dressed in their Sunday best, and they'd do the sort of porters and all, like when there'd be a party and that sort. You know, they were treated quite well. But they held the houses for nominal rents. Every one of these houses were owned by the Guinness estate family, which is now the government have, you know. And they were, I know ours was 2 and 6 a week, number four. But the others had them cheaper. Some of them had them for a shilling a week, you know. There was murder when they went up to 4 shillings a week.
Did your father talk about the management he was doing the horses? Was he kind of a man that would talk about his work and talk about
Not
the
really, no. He had served in the British Army in the First World War.
Oh, did he?
Oh yeah. And this was the open sesame to any Guinness job if you were in the British Army, ex-British Army. And in fact, all my brothers went to work in the brewery, but not all of them, but four of them. And it was all because my father worked on the Guinness estate. That's how they got into the brewery, you know. Lord Ivy saw to it that they got jobs in the brewery.
And when you think of Guinness as being such a remarkable place, and I suppose the name Guinness would be synonymous with Ireland. I mean, you could go anywhere, you know. So it was an important, was it a good job to get into Guinness's?
It was, yeah. Now, to get into the brewery was a great job because they started there at £5 a week, which was colossal. It was nearly double what a farm labourer was getting. The farm labourers never got anything higher at that time than £2 and 5 shillings, and they had a big fight to get the 5 bob. But the brewery was a great job, One of my brothers was actually killed there in 1953. In an accident in the brewery.
What happened?
They had upright vats at that time, and he had cleaned the vat and was going up with the equipment on his shoulder, and he fell backwards into a 30-foot drop into the vat. Yeah, he was killed.
My goodness.
And he had been through the war. He was in the Second World War in the British Army, and he had been out in the desert fighting Rommel, and he was killed in the brewery.
My goodness, yeah.
Yeah.
So that's if you were working on the estate here, you were sure of a job inside Guinness.
Yeah, great chances because the first foreman from here was Micheál Hanlon, who lived in number 3, and his father worked on the estate as well. So they usually went. Now I was offered a job in the brewery, but I didn't like the idea of it. It was too regimental for me, place where you had to clock in and out of the tiles even at that time. No, didn't appeal to me.
But just take me through your own growing up here. Did you go to school locally?
Yeah, we went to school locally. We went to school up in the village. That school was opened in 1885. Originally, there were two schools down here in Mill Lane, one for girls and one for boys, and they were interdenominational as well. But when the new school was built in 1885, all the Protestant children went to Chapel Isard, and the Catholic children, which was a pity, they separated us. They couldn't separate us down here because it was half and half in religion, and we didn't even know they were Protestant. We thought they just went to Mass somewhere else. It never arose. But we went to school. We used to walk up the lane. Most of the children in the school, there were 90 children or so in that school, and most of them were from Mill Lane, down here, in the original Palmerstown. We'd have, in my family, there were 8 boys and 1 girl, and most of the families along the row were around that number, 6 to 7 children. So quite a few. And we went up there to an unheated school. You hear them moaning nowadays about comfort. We used to have to carry up a little log under your arm or a sod of turf, and everybody brought it, and the master warmed himself in front of the fire while the kids froze. There was one, actually there were one male teacher and 2 female teachers. Funny enough, the 2 heads, the one that succeeded the other as headmaster up there, were O'Connors, and they were brothers.
Any relation?
No relation, no. Yeah. I think they came from Tipperary originally.
Yeah. And your schooling days, had you any problems? Did you enjoy them?
No, I was a teacher's pet, a bit of a know-all, and was cordially hated by the other kids, particularly in the higher class. Hadn't got the good sense to keep my mouth shut. The master used to do it deliberately. He'd have his class up around them, and the senior boys and girls, and he'd ask them a question which he couldn't answer, and he'd say, "Hugh," and I, like an idiot, would get up and pray it off. Because I used to read a lot. I read it. But see, the opportunities weren't there for us in those days. It cost money for a secondary education, so you didn't get it. That was that.
Yeah.
You went to work as soon as you were old enough to go out to work. I was different. Mind you, I went to tech for 2 years. So that was a bit different.
Why did you decide, or why did your parents decide to put you into tech?
My mother.
Did you have a flair for?
My father was dead by that time. My mother just decided that I'd go to the tech. And I got the entrance scholarship and a continuation scholarship, which meant that my books were paid for. I was actually paid money to go to tech.
This would be pre-war years, wasn't it?
This was the late 40s.
You were born in 1934.
34, yeah. You were 14 going to tech. That was the age when you did the tech at. And you came out of the tech at 16.
And you said your father died young as well.
I was 13 when my father died, yeah.
And that left your mother with a big family.
Oh, yeah. But we had one brother, Stephen, and Stephen took over. And he went actually and joined the British Merchant Navy. And from the day he went away, he sent home with his first wages, £3 a week to my mother. And that went on, that raised us, because that was more than my father was earning. You know, we were relatively rich because he sent it endlessly. And my mother used to write to him and say, "We're all right now." And he'd say, "No, so you only drink it, you know."
Imagine.
Yeah. And all those years, because at sea they didn't spend their money.
Yeah.
You know, they robbed the cargo or whatever when they wanted to get drunk. But he was drowned in New Zealand, Stephen, even when he was 50.
Wow, there was a lot of tragedy in the
family. Yeah, there was another brother, Christy. He was killed with a car leak slip. He was hit by a car.
Yeah. Mm. I mean, did you ever think about? I mean, it's worrying, isn't it? You know.
Oh yeah, my sister died in childbirth in England. You see, and we used to be always saying, you know, they're talking about Mrs. Kennedy having tragedy. So we had more with as much, you know, and we hadn't got the money to go with it. We were poor. But my mother was a real tough character. She was from the north, you know, and you know the way they are.
What was your mother's maiden name?
Carolyn.
Carolyn.
Yeah.
And what parts of the north?
A place called Guildford. Now, she left there when she was 10 and lived with my father, my grandfather in Dundalk. But his first wife died when my mother was very small, and he married again. And she was great, Annie.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they came to live up here in Palmerstown in the coach house, what's now the coach house.
Yeah.
And on the top of that they lived. He looked after the herd, where stewards kept their own herd of cattle in those days. And he looked after the cow herd there. my granny used to share with the work, of course. She'd milk the cattle and all, no bother to her.
Yeah. She must have been a tough woman.
Oh. Now, she's some sayings I couldn't...
Go on, tell me.
One time, my mother used to tell this story, when the lads were on the run, a detective came over the gate one night, climbed over the gate at the yard. The gate was always locked.
Was this the Civil War now or the
This War would be the War of Independence. Yes. And my mother used to tell us these yarns. You know, I used to, you know, I didn't know whether to believe it or not. But anyway, one night this detective came over and the dog, of course, attacked. And your man took out a gun. And Granny came out in her nightdress with a pitchfork in her hand and she said, "Sonny, shoot that dog and the last of your shite is made."
And she confronted him.
Oh, like, yeah. And your man got back over the gate. And she had sayings like, she used to call another kid who was sly a sidey bastard. I don't know where they came from, you know. But she was real tough, but she was the heart and soul of goodness, you know.
Yeah. But, you know, to go through all that, torture in having all those crosses to bear and to come out of the other side, you know. And still,
oh, yeah, yeah. Well, my mother was really strong, yeah.
So having a brother send back money while out at sea and your mother being the backbone and rearing you quite well, it was a good foundation, wasn't it, for an upbringing here?
Oh, it was, yeah. And
So did you go work with Guinnesses then? No, you didn't. You decided not to.
No, I went into Superior Packaging. It was a printing house.
Where was that?
It's up in Finglas now. It was originally up at Lucan. Font Hill. There was the old tram station there. That's where the factory started. So I worked in there. Then that was it. I worked there all my life.
Yeah, yeah. Hmm. Palmerstown itself is it's an ancient place.
Yes.
It's a place which has indeed a lot of history attached to it. You spoke about the coach house. Was that a place for changing horses? And
it was. That was the coach from Mullingar. He used to come through there. Now, there's a man up in King's Hospital School, Glasscott Sims, and he has a map, and it shows the route of the coach. It unfolds and it shows the route of the Mullingar coach coming along and the stops all along the way.
And this is this here in Parmestown was one of those
one
stops,
of those stops. Yeah, they changed the horses there for the last pull into town, which was three four miles. You know.
And was there a boarding house here as well?
I'd imagine there was. There is actually a song written about the Parmestown fleas, and it's about a boarding house in Parmestown infested with fleas.
Go away.
Yeah. My wife wouldn't let me have it published in this. She wouldn't let it go into it for some reason or other. Yeah. The Palmerstown fleas.
Yes. But you can imagine there would be a lot of fleas in a place like that because, I mean, you've got lads coming in pouring with perspiration and, you know, their clothes would certainly be the same clothes they wore for a long time. And
up until when we were growing up, there was fleas, but then DDT came and lethal doses of DDT were spread in the beds and the people breathing it in never knew what they were breathing. You know, and that's what wiped out the domestic flea.
Yeah.
He was gone.
What are your early memories of the war, the Second World War? You know, because you lived through the emergency period.
Yeah, well, I was in the scouts. We used to take part in the manoeuvres. We were the casualties usually, and they used to have practice manoeuvres. You know, for rescuing people from bombing and all that. There was an old chocolate factory which had burned down, and on the site of the chocolate factory, they used to have these bonfires. You know, Palmerstown is burning type of thing, and then the firefighters had come. And all of the local security force and all would be out helping people. And I remember I was a casualty who was supposed to be blinded up in Robin Villas. It's a place above where the British soldiers' houses were built. And I was brought down then to the place where they had the emergency hospital, you know, and there was a doctor there, actually, the real doctor. He was actually the doctor in the Stuart Hospital, Dr. Smith, Henry St. George Smith. And he would do the examination, then you'd be let go, you know, or whatever.
But this was a reenactment, was it?
Yeah.
Of the real thing,
that was
what
right.
Could happen.
Yeah, the Southern Command would invade Dublin. They'd come up and the others would be there to repulse them. The local security men would be checking out at checkpoints, you know, to see could they spot the enemy. But here the enemy, I remember, used to come down. They came down here. And the people would invite them in for a cup of tea. It was all a bit of a game.
Yeah.
War manoeuvres. Things that never happened. They had big barriers at Chapel Isidford to stop tanks right across the road there. They had a huge railway, you know, the girders, the railway lines, and they used to push these across the road. And these were supposed to stop. They wouldn't have stopped the tanks, but they were there anyway. And another thing they did was, which I always given out about now, they ripped off any permanent signs that were in stone. And for instance, Palmerstown School, if you look at the school there, the thing is still on it, but it's all, the lettering was torn off it. Palmerstown was torn off it. So the Germans wouldn't know where they were if they invaded, or the English, I suppose, for that matter. It was all so simple. My God.
When you think of it, yeah, when, you know, the, but what about the rationing? You know, there was coupons. And,
yeah, now the rationing was, all we remember, we always seemed to have plenty. See, we had the brothers, one in the Merchant Navy and the others in the Army. And when they come home and leave, they would bring tea. Now, tea was selling on the black market about £5 a pound. But we used to get 14 pounds of it or so would be brought in by the lads, especially the fellow who was at sea, because they were never questioned. He'd show a seaman's pass and they wouldn't bother with him. And he'd have this thing full of tea and all sorts of things. Like, he used to bring us home cigarettes, we all smoked in those days. And he'd bring home things we hadn't seen. One of our lads was in Africa and he came home directly and he brought home oranges.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, God, we'd never seen them, you know. It were great things, you know. But yeah, we used to get plenty of tea. And my mother, of course, was one of these people who If she got this big load of tea, it had to be divided among the neighbours. That was that. You know, there was no question about it. And the people would be delighted when they see Stephen coming home because, oh, here the tea is coming out.
And there would be sharing going on.
Share everything. And that was one thing the people did in those days. They shared. They had very little, but they shared it.
Mm-hmm.
And there was, of course, that great atmosphere among the people, helping one another.
And did you experience that always here?
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Even though things were bad, you know, you could still, if there was something left over, it would be passed to the neighbours.
And my father used to cut all the local kids' hair free of charge. He was the only one that had a hair machine, and he cut all their hair. And my mother used to make suits from men's suits. She cut them down and make them for a fellow who had he was a Church of Ireland. He had a Sunday school going, and he used to get these suits made. My mother used to make them at a half crown a go.
And she used to reduce the size of suits.
She cut them down and made. She had patterns for making the suits, and she she made all our clothes. Like there's a photograph of me in there wearing the trousers that she made. When I was about 3 or 4 in that.
Yeah.
Mm.
Did immigration ever come into your head when you were growing up?
Yeah, I decided I was going to emigrate to Canada. And I came out of a monastery. I didn't tell you that.
And, did you do? Go back. Yeah. Tell me about the monastery.
Well, I was working as an apprentice fitter in Weatherwell Limited, Clondalkin. And I decided then religion was a thing for me. So I joined the Servite Order in Benbourbon, County Tyrone. That'd be 1952. Yeah, and I did a couple of years there, but they decided I wasn't suitable for the religious life, and I was sent home. So then I decided I was going to emigrate to Canada. And I went into that job to make the money to emigrate to Canada, and spent the rest of my life there. It was a good job, well paid, very good to their workers. It was a Dutchman actually was running it at the time. And then it was taken over by the English, who were even better employers, you know. The English were great because they promoted from the floor, and they were, you know, they were very ordinary. There's nothing like Irish employers tend to be a bit arrogant, I think.
Well, yes, but the workplace, you were producing packaging.
Packaging.
For who?
Wax bread wrappers. The wax bread wrapper had come in around 1950 or so. In fact, when I came home on holidays from the monastery, I saw for the first time the wax bread wrapper, which I thought was very interesting. And I never thought I'd spend the rest of my life producing the stuff. But the wax bread wrapper and the crisp bags, you know, all that sort of thing, and then plastic bread wrappers. I went to Belgium to look at machinery there for producing the bread bags, and I went to England and all to see the machinery. You know, I sent it around quite a bit.
Excuse me. Where was the factory?
The factory was at in the old tram station. That's where it started. And we moved from there down to North Wall.
Hmm.
And in 1959, the place was burned to the ground in the North Wall. And we were sent to Holland to await the opening of the new factory. But when we got to Holland, and we were working there for just a few weeks, they told us they weren't going to reopen in Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
And they weren't going to pay our fare home. So we were sort of stuck there, but we all got together and pooled our money, and we all came home.
How many of you?
There were 6 of us.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're sent off.
What was the name of the company? Sorry. What was the name of
Superior Packaging. And it was spelt in the French Superior. And then the English changed it to Superior, which it still is. I've lost contact now for years.
Yeah.
That was it. When I look back and I say, gee, what a waste of life. I should have gone to Canada. Producing rubbish.
Where did you meet your wife?
Oh, sure, I knew her. No, she got mad, I tell you. I remember this when she was born. See, she was born same house as I was above.
What's your wife's name?
Nuala.
Nuala.
Murray.
Murray, yeah.
Yeah. I met Nuala when she was a baby. Her mother, they lived up there, you see. You'd have to see the house. Their house ran that way and ours ran that way.
In right angles.
Yeah. And we were down here. I came down here, down the other one, number four, and then when I was 3 years old. So Nuala was born, she's 7 years younger than me. And we knew her all my life. She was one of the kids around the place. But then I was best man at my brother's wedding, and he married Nuala's sister. And Nuala was bridesmaid. Nuala was 15, I think, at that time. And I was 22. But when she was 17, I asked her out. And to my amazement, she said, yes, you know. So that was it. We never looked back. We got married 3 years later. Her 21st birthday present was a son.
Oh, yeah.
Ronan was born when Nuala was 21. I was in England. My sister had died. And my mother said, met me. What are you doing here? Go home. You know, the mother, she lived in England for a good while. She had gone, moved to England with my sister because she wasn't too well.
Mm.
And she chased me off home.
Yeah.
And in Liverpool, I visited a cousin in Liverpool on the way home before I got the boat. And she said, now, Hugh, if it's a boy, call him Ronan. A good Irish name. So I did. That's how Ronan got his name.
And how long have you been married for?
46 years. This is the 47th, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. We had 7 children. One adopted, Declan. He's in Australia. He worked with Qantas now for 15 years. Now he's left Qantas and he's doing sort of freelance. He's an aircraft mechanic.
Do you mind me asking, you know, with such a big family and such a big lot of responsibility, the adoption, what made you decide that?
It came in the middle, you see. We were talking one day about people always nowadays, all they can talk about is not having children, you know. And the place, orphanages were full of children at that time. So we said, well, instead of having another of our own, we'll adopt one. Which then we found his photograph in the Word magazine. Mm-hmm. And when we applied, they said, ah, no, you're young and you have so many. We had 4 of our own at that time, it was 3. And they said, no, to, you know. Then all of a sudden they seemed to change their mind, and the social worker came out one day and said, well, look, what do you think of him? And he said, oh, God, he's lovely. And he was half Pakistani. Oh, don't that.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
But right enough, we adopted him then. But they couldn't find the mother.
Yeah.
And because she had disappeared off face of the earth, apparently, after she left him in the home. But this priest turned up and he swore an affidavit that if the mother would give permission for him to be adopted, because he knew her. So that was what happened. And after 2 years, was it? We had him before he was adopted. Yeah. And we had to go before the adoption board. Lady Wicklow was the chair of the adoption board. You know, yeah, we came trooping in with all the kids. And she says, oh, which one is Declan? You know, he was lost among the others, you know. So,
yeah.
But that was it. He was a great lad. He's great. Just a card from there from you. He's in New Zealand at the moment.
Yeah. And living, you know, living here so close to the city and yet so far out in the country.
It's a real rural setting here, you know. It was real country and it was great. We had the advantage of up there, get the bus into town, you were into the city, you know.
Yeah.
And we still have the best bus service in the country. But
The man who built these houses was a Crampton.
Yeah.
Was it George Crampton?
George Crampton, yeah. Yeah.
And they were, as you said earlier, that, you know, they were built sometime in the beginning of the 1800s, weren't they?
They were, yeah. They were built, how do you see? I remember George Fitzgerald telling me when they were built. I'd say it was probably 1900 or thereabouts when that site was cleared.
Yeah.
That would give it, yeah, it'd be 100, yeah. That would, might be a bit earlier. Yeah.
But when, you know, when you look out your window now and you can see not too much has changed. It's very much...
No. To me, an awful lot has changed.
Yeah.
You see, we look out there. Across, right in front of this house, there were gardens from four of the houses. We had one, number four, we had a garden on that side. It used to be called the Island. And it's now a lawn. Or the factory, they made a beautiful job of it. And behind that, those gardens, there was a ruin of an old iron smelter. It must have, when that iron, what do you call it, clinkers are still lying around the place. You know, they capped walls with them, and they're still around here, you know, quite common. But what happened there was they leveled it off for a car park. What else is you? Yeah. And the old ruins were cleared away, and the forge was called the forge down there. It was demolished. There's a picture of it. You've seen it. I have it in that up there.
Oh yes, you have a photograph in the wall. And who was the blacksmith?
They were fellas, they worked in the iron factory. Whatever sort of work they did.
Oh, there was an iron smelter yeah, factory. Yeah, yeah. And
the blacksmith locally was up in the village up above in Palmerstown, what's now the village of Palmerstown.
Yeah.
I don't know whether I should mention his name. Christy Merriman was a blacksmith there. And after him, Louis Dardis. Yeah. And they used to shoe the horses there. They were, you know, farriers. And they built gates and all. They were highly skilled men, actually.
I'd say they were busy, you know, with all the traffic coming and going at the time.
Especially the horse people, whites, had 100 acres of land up there. Mm-hmm. And they ran literally hundreds of horses on it. And those horses were exported to Germany up until the war started.
Yeah.
And, of course, the farriers were very busy cleaning up the hooves and shoeing them before they went away. Actually, the last time they went, two of my brothers went to England with the horses from White's.
Did they?
Yeah.
And they
each man
accompanied the horses.
Yeah, each man had a string of horses.
Yes.
Nine, I think it was, each they brought.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So it was a very close-knit group of people out here, you know, that if your brothers helped with the horses, everybody would seem to be helping one another out here. And
yeah, well, they would be paid for that job. Yeah, yeah. But they, yeah, they worked on the local farms.
But everybody helped, and so it was a hive of activity, was it?
Oh, it was. Yeah. Now across the way here, a few hundred yards, there was a farm. Imagine this was all farmland, and they were all active working farms, and they're almost in the city. And my brother Stephen worked on that farm before he went off to sea. And my father worked on it for a while. I worked on it. When I was 16, I was milking 20 cows over there. And all of us worked on it at different times in our lives. You know, when I'd be on holidays from Tech, I always worked on the farm.
Hmm.
The man who owned it was from Clare, funny enough.
What was his name?
Jack McMahon.
Mm-hmm.
Very Clare name.
Yeah.
Yeah. And his son, Vincent, he became a doctor afterwards. Yeah. Yeah, I think he lives in Canada.
And did your brother or your father come home with any war stories from fighting?
No, he was very reticent about the war. No, didn't talk about it. In fact, he had three marks of wounds. One here, right across there, he had a scar.
Across his eye?
Right across, yeah. And he had a... We never saw this one. It's a hole in his leg, and the back of his hand here was all pulled together where it had been repaired, you know. But There was a story about him that my mother used to tell. He was missing for a year and presumed dead. And my her sister went up to visit a man in the Royal Hospital, Kilmainham. McCarthy was his name. She married him afterwards. And he was a sailor. And she went up to visit him there. And she saw my father sitting in a bed. And she looked at the thing. It said he was Scottish. But she went home and told my mother. And he was suffering from amnesia.
No idea where he was.
No idea where he was. But when my mother came up to see him, his memory all came back.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so that's how we came about. He wasn't dead after all.
My God. Mm. So it was a very joyful homecoming.
It was, yeah.
But what a surprise for your mother to go up and find him there.
What I find strange about the people, they didn't talk much about their past life at all. Excuse me. They learned very little about their past, you know, just in snatches you got stories. And it was probably because there were so many of us, you know, when you've got 8 kids to look after, 9 kids, you don't have time to sit down and tell stories. And of course we had no radio, no television or anything like that. My father used to read to us in front of the fire at night, you know.
Yeah.
And that was all the entertainment you had. You had no electric light until 1937. And the electricity came in 37, but it was years after before anyone could afford the 10 shillings it took to get it installed. And then when it was installed, it was one single light in one room, which was the main room, which nowadays would be called the dining room. In those days, it was just the room. And I can still remember the electricity coming, even though I was only 3 years old, because I remember the huge coils of wire and all the activity in the fields and the poles going up. These are things that stick in your mind forever.
Oh, yes.
But the electricity was put into our house by a man called Tom Williams, who was an electrician who had come over from England as the electrician on the Guinness estate. They brought their tradesmen from England. And he came. His whole family came. His father came to do some other function on the estate. So they settled in Rose Cottage below. And their grandson, is still a great friend of mine, Joe. Joe regularly comes down to see me.
Right.
Yeah. And he's a historian. He has written on the Round Towers of Ireland. And he tells everybody, I started him off on the road. The Clondalkin History Society.
Yeah. Joe Williams, yeah.
And just shout Joe Williams in Clondalkin and they'll know. It's all over. Just, you know, you hear the hand down by word of mouth. They didn't. They kept everything quiet. You knew very little about your grandparents or anything. In fact, I was going, a fella offered me the use of his cottage in Wexford to go down there and stay a couple of weeks and study, go around asking my relatives down there about my father, you know. But I never got around to it, you know.
Yeah.
It's one of these things you put on the long finger. But,
you know, when you think of your grandparents living over the coach house, you know, that must have been, you know, to hear stories handed down would have been great. Did you know your grandparents?
No.
Or were you too young?
No, they were dead before I was born. No, I knew my grandfather, yeah. He lived with my mother and father up at what's now number 4. It's a ruin. It's actually all sheeted up, you know. But he lived with them for a while. But then one day he came home and he says, well, I'm leaving now. And my mother said she got a shock of her life. Even where? He had got into the Little Sisters of the Poor in Kilmainham, the old folks' home there. Until he died, he looked after the fowl there, the hens and all in the yard. And we used to go up and visit him. And in the hen house, he used to take out this tin, a couple of pennies for it all, you know. John Carlin.
And just one morning, he got up and he just said, look, I'm going.
Now, he decided he was too much of, you know, there were so many kids.
Yeah.
Like I remember my father saying, when he came home, when I was born and said to my grandfather, "It's a boy." "What the hell with you and your boy?" he says. "There's too many of them."
But I suppose, you know, that being brought up in that kind of atmosphere as well, you just said no radio, no television, nothing like that. So your entertainment, what did you do to pass the time?
I think we must have had ideal. My wife's always on about we had ideal childhoods down here because we wandered all over the place. And we, during school holidays, we'd just disappear. And our parents would see us in the evening when we were hungry. We come home. We lived a really wild life. It was brilliant.
You had the freedom of being able to run around
all over
the fields.
In the summertime in the river, we'd be in the river day and night, swimming in the river. Oh, yeah, there was plenty to do. And then we used to cover great distances. Nowadays, kids don't walk very far. We'd go off. There's a place, it's way over called Irish Town. It's not called Irish Town anymore. They changed the name. I suppose there were too many Irish towns around. But we'd walk over there. It'd be 5-6 miles, you know. And we used to hunt the goats over there, trying to catch them, wild goats. And whenever we got in trouble, like, and it was fairly innocuous, the trouble. I remember one time we were down, there was an island in the river. We were down there playing. And time went by, and the river was rising, and we never noticed. And when we went to go, we couldn't get across. We were on the island, and my brother Bill, very resourceful, he got a long stick and he pulled the boat across. Mm-hmm. It was on a chain, and we got into the boat and pulled. And we were seen doing this, and the man who saw us reported us to the boat's owner. Oh, this was big trouble, you know. But anyway, the lady came down. We were down in one of the ruins of the mills, and we used to play in them. We were down there. And she came in and started to berate us over the boat. And we got mud balls and plaster. Of course, we daredn't go home then. We were in trouble. But what we used to do was we'd gather huge piles of fire light or sticks and bring them home. And the mother would say, "Oh, well, count on bringing home the sticks. We got off."
You softened her out by
doing
that.
That's what we did. Mm. Yeah. But we used to raid orchards and all that sort of thing. But nobody'd know. We used to light fires in the mills, you know, sit around the fire and get up to all sorts.
Yeah.
You know, games and all we used to play. Ah, oh, it was great.
It was a different kind of childhood.
Was
there Boy Scouts or anything? Did you get involved?
Yeah, we were in
those?
The Scouts. Yeah. We'd go up to the Scouts. Now, it was a real hodgepodge. You know, couldn't afford a uniform, so we'd have bits and pieces of uniforms. But it was well run. There was a man from Robin Villas used to run it, and he was a very dedicated man, you know, very, very good. And they teach you, you know, the knots and all that. And the reason I left the Scouts was I forgot to salute the crucifix when I come in one morning. I was in trouble, and I told you, man, left.
That was the end of that.
That was the end of my scouting days. And my father wanted to know, why did you leave the scout?
What about the, you know, the 50s, when you lived through the 50s? They were lean years. Things weren't going well at all.
Yeah. Well,
here.
I went into the monastery in 52 and came out in 54.
So you did 2 years.
Yeah.
And what decided you not to go ahead? I mean,
they decided.
Oh, they decided.
In those days, they had so many vocations. There was more going out than coming in. They were, you know, they'd let the brothers go for no reason at all. And I was talking to one of the priests there recently, and he said they let the wrong ones go. You know, they kept the businessmen, you know.
Yeah. Mm. But go on, you were going to tell me about the monastery.
Yeah, well, I was going to be a brother, of course, because we had never done it. You had to have the leaving cert go on for the priesthood. But it was great. Oh, it was really lovely. I loved every minute I was in it. You know, they were great.
Yeah.
It was a real family feeling to it. There were 75 in that monastery, and about 30 of them were Americans. Mm-hmm. And the Americans were really good. That's how I came to like Americans. They were really good guys, you know.
Yeah, yeah. The name of the order were the Servites.
Yeah.
Describe what kind of an order they were.
Well, they're a mendicant order. They were the same contemporary with the Franciscans and the Dominicans. They were founded around the same time. They had seven founders. I can name them all if I think about it. But they had seven founders, and they wore a habit the same as the Dominicans, only all black. And there was, you know, the same system. The prior was the head of the monastery, and then they had the provincial who was the head of the province. But the province was the American province when I was there. They have a new province now. It's called the Province of the Isles, where Scotland, England, Ireland are all the one. But they're very, very low in numbers now. That time, they were queuing up to get into monasteries. You know, there was no damper. They had brothers. The brothers ran the place. I used to milk the cows up there, cook the meals. And there was a lay cook in the, he was a chef. He was actually chairman of the association in Ireland. And he was a brilliant chef. And I worked with him. And we were great friends. You weren't allowed to smoke, but I used to get the cigarettes from Paddy anyway. Yeah.
And you know, you spoke earlier about that you were a great book reader, that you, as a young lad, you read an awful lot.
Yeah.
Did this stay with you?
Oh, indeed, yeah. One of my fanatical subjects is the North American Indians, Native Americans. I think I've read about everything that was ever written about them. I had a whole library collected over the years, and I gave them all to Oxfam. I gave about 500 books to Oxfam, but all my library of American Indians went. So I'm starting to gather them again, you know.
And what was the attraction? Was it because it was it just something that was you enjoyed?
Yeah, I enjoyed. Well, when we were kids, we'd be playing cowboys and Indians, and I was always an Indian. I couldn't be a cowboy, you know. The Indians to me were the real heroes, and we used to go, of course, to the cinema. That was one of the entertainments, and it was on a Saturday, and each of us would follow our own. We always went on a Saturday to see Johnny McBrown, whereas my brother-in-law John and the other lads would go on a Sunday to see Dick Thorne. That was his name, I think. Yeah, their hero. But we used to see Johnny McBrown, and we knew the Indians all by name, you know. And we played, and you'd be supposed to be riding your horse, you know.
Oh, where was the cinema?
Cinema was in Chapel, is it?
Oh, yes, yeah.
Yeah, it's actually a factory now. It was, it opened first as the Ritz, with those posh names. Then it became the Majestic. What was it called after? The Grove. No, that was Lucan, the Grove. What the heck was it? The Ritz, Majestic. I can't remember what the other name was. It kept changing the name.
And these places had pits and, you know, the stalls. And,
yeah, well, it was all mostly on the same level, but they came, you know, on a slant. But the ones, the cushioned seats were the dear ones. And then it was three pence in for this matinee, you know. And then it went up to fourpence, I remember. But we used to run all the way down from Harmstown to Chapel Izzet. I remember one time we had the shilling and we had threepence for the bus back. And my brother Christy was carrying the money anyway. When we decided we were going to be late, we would miss the Folliar Upper, as it was called. So we got the bus halfway down the Harmstown Hill. But when we got to the cinema, he found he lost the shilling.
Oh.
We all ran back to where we got the bus. found the shill and ran all the way back down to the cinema. And we got there in time.
Going back again now, before we finish, I want to go and find out more about the farming that was going on here. The McMahon man that had the land.
Yeah.
Did he drive his cattle into Dublin to the fair? Or
I drove in at 4 o'clock in the morning, driving cattle into the Dublin cattle market, which is now all built on. You know, it's gone. But we drive in the morning early, and I drove cattle from Leixlip. He had land. He had the Conacre was what he worked on. And he'd land in Leixlip, and he'd land in Palmerston, he'd all over. And I drove cattle from Leixlip into the Dublin cattle market. And I was only a kid then, 16 years of age, you know. And thought nothing of it.
Yeah, and in those days, not a lot of traffic on the road, of course.
No, not a sign of a car or anything like that. And you go along, the cattle would be sleepy, walking along there, and you're coming behind them. The wages, of course, were little or nothing. Well, it was £2 a week, actually, then.
Yeah. Mm. And tell me a little bit about the fair, then, where the jobbers, would they come up and would you hang around all day and watch what was going on?
No, we drive them in, and then usually we go back on the bus. We'd have to milk the cattle, you know, and clean out the sheds and all. We're over here. And we'd be working the normal day on the farm. And then if there were cattle, his son would drive the ones back that weren't sold, you know. You had to do it one way. And there was a man called Stephen Hannon who worked over there, and Stephen used to go and drive in as well, drive the cattle.
Yeah, and the milking then, was that all hand done?
No, he was very, very advanced. Way back then, he had a machine.
Yeah.
You know, and
how was it? Was there some way of driving it, you know, the...
Oh, yeah, it was driven on it was electric, actually, the drive, you know, and he had a very sophisticated system. All the pipes used to run along, and you plugged the thing into it. And I was expert at doing it. And my brother Sal worked at it from time to time. And just cleaning the machine was the worst part of it. You had to clean it, and the inspectors would come to make sure it was clean. And you'd be... brushes to go down through the pipes and all, but he was very far ahead like that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and crushers for the mangles, you know, they were electrically operated, so he wasn't a slow coach, Jack, no, very advanced, but very religious. Don't provoke that. He went to mass every day. Yeah. Ooh.
And that isn't exactly what you were doing, I'd say.
No.
You know, I suppose going through, like you said, you spent so long, a great part of your life working in the packaging factory, you know.
Yeah.
If you had your way all over again, what route would you take the same route again?
Nah, that's a good question. I probably would, you know. Because that was a good... The packaging factory, there were great people to work for. There was a great crowd of lads there. We socialised a hell of a lot together. And the mayor of the county, Billy, eventually he became manager there and I became foreman. The reason they made him manager was he was a member of the Irish Graphical Society. The printers wouldn't take orders from anybody who wasn't, you know. Fair enough, and he was better for the job anyway. He was very good at it.
Mm. When did you retire?
Now I got angina, and I retired for reasons of health, but I feel as healthy as cricket, you know. Can't remember. How long ago was that?
You know, in your retirement, how do you pass the time?
Oh, I love it. Doing nothing is the greatest thing on earth, you know. But now you see, I was a collector. I don't collect so much now. I used to collect bottles, and I did a bit of painting, and there's no problem getting a muse. I have a friend who was one of the leading artists in the country, Peter, and now I go down to him. He lives in Wexford, and I look after the farm there while he goes off and the missus and the kids go off on holidays, you know. And I've been doing this for years now. In fact, I'm going down 7th of March. Well, there's very little left on the farm now to look after. There's only 4 cows, and there's the goat, the geese, and a few hens. I think that's all that's left. You know, you used to have 28, 30 pigs, you know,
yeah.
And they had a big herd of cattle that they ate there, and they were milking, and none of them milking, they were all dry. And then they had the geese, a couple of dozen of them, loads of hens. But they have cut back, you know, on the farm. He's an artist, and he's a sales, and he's an author. He has written 5 books,
yeah,
all about Dublin, mm-hmm. Dunleary. You know, Between the Mountains and the Sea is one of his, and Decorative Dublin. He's written loads of books. Very bright, very humble man, you know.
And you know, talking
he did the forward for that. Actually.
Talking just before I leave you go, your late daughter Nessa wrote a wonderful book here on Palmerstown and its history. I'm sure you helped out enormously with this.
Oh yeah, well, see, Nessa was my best friend as well as being a daughter.
So you said that she was your best friend?
Yeah, as well as being a daughter, because she had exactly the same interests. You know, I was in Antashka for years, the whole family were, and everywhere I went, Nessa went, you know, with anything historic, and she developed a colossal interest, and she was far better at it than me, you know, she was more practical and not empty-headed, but she collected up over the years, and everything I used to say about history, she'd write down,
yeah.
You know, and then it went in there in one way or another, you know, and I used to collect stuff, anything of historic interest. She did a lot of research. She went in, you know, to the library, endlessly studying about the locality. She actually died when she had it all on floppy disk. She had it all on her computer when she died, and it was my wife drove that through and got it published and all, yeah. Did all the work, yeah.
Yeah.
She was brilliant. You know, she's very single-minded. If she would decide something, that's going to happen, and that's that. And that did. So Nessa was immortalized in her book, and there. That's for there.
Yeah. But I suppose when you look at something like that, it really does tell you about the locality, the people, the way of life. Everything is in that, you know.
It's all there, yeah. Mm-hmm. And you see, we use this. That's myself there.
As a what? A 3-year-old.
3-year-old, and that's the trousers my mother made from her old red coat. Yeah, that's my brother Bill. That's my brother Christy there.
Yeah.
Phyllis Kelly.
And in the background, the house.
That's Rivermount. It's over there.
Yes, yeah.
That's the painting I did of it there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah. You know, it's an amazing story when you think of the with so little money, how your mother managed to bring you all up and to keep it, and it comes out very clearly in the book there, doesn't it? You know, you know, nothing went to waste. Everything was pieced together, and
that's right. When you think, my father died at 50, and I was 13 years old. Now, we still had 2 younger than me, Joe and Tom. And my mother used to, she took over my father, and she'd mend their shoes, soles and heels. She was expert at it, and make her clothes. She did how she stretched the money as well, you know. It was miraculous. And yet she was always given, 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 you know.
Yeah.
And there was a tradition in our house. If a person came to the door begging, they were brought in, sit down at the table.
Yeah.
There was one man who used to come, and he was from my mother's hometown, and he had been very wealthy. They were a wealthy family. But he had been the black sheep, and the drink got him, and he took to the roads. But he used to come every Tuesday, yeah, mm-hmm. And we would all have to be very respectful to him. And I'll never forget, the old age pension at that time was about 10 shillings. And when he qualified for the old age pension, he came with bags of sweets for us all.
You know, in every place you had characters, and they were the colour. And they had such wit, didn't they?
And they're gone now. This is what, will they ever be there again, these characters? You know, they were such characters. There was an old chap up the road, they used to call him Death on Two Wires. I don't know why. And probably like a puppet, you know. And Salonika Pat, they had, was another name they had on him. He had been an old soldier, you know, when he was at Salonika. But, oh, shit, he was a character. He was a Mayo man. Came to live up, and the houses are gone now. They've demolished them. Yeah. They demolished a lot of houses. If you see this, I did this painting a few years back. I did it from an old photograph that was in the 1890s. And you see the row of houses at the top there, all gone. Every one of them.
Yeah, no, this is an aerial photograph. So you have...
It's actually from the hill beyond.
So the river is... here in the foreground.
Yeah.
And then you have the mill.
Yeah, this one, that's it over there.
Yeah.
And it actually, if the Liffey has no name, this is one thing they never point out. That's not the name of the river at all. That's the plain it runs through, the Liffey. It's on the Liffey. It's the river of the Liffey. It has no name. An awful lot of people miss that.
I didn't know that.
No, they always talk about the river Liffey. It's the Liffey River.
Yeah. The Liffey is the place, the river is flowing through the Liffey.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. And the mill itself then.
That was the
bread and butter of the place for years.
Yeah, it was a furniture factory at one stage. You see that timber outside it.
Yeah.
And you see the blue grey house in the background? That's the one we're in now. That's my house.
Yeah.
Our house. And then the row, there were six of those smaller cottages which were demolished, and then George Crampton built the other four on the site.
Oh, yes.
And up at the back, in the background, the pink houses, incidentally, I painted in four in that row, but there were actually only three. And they were never finished. They were built and never finished. They were back-to-back houses.
And what was the purpose?
They were to be finished, but I suppose what happened was the industries in the place died out and the people went. But they started to collapse in 1947, so they levelled them.
Mm-hmm.
A man called Tom Connor knocked them down.
And the big house then on the left, you can just see it in the picture.
Yeah,
that's Rivermount.
Yeah. And this... at the end of the pink houses, there's one there in a sort of a green. That was a schoolhouse for girls. And the other, the L shape there, the end one of that was a school for boys.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a great story there. In the girls' school, the priest had the windows at the back blocked up, the girls' school, because they overlooked the boys' toilets. Oh, jiggers. And that's a fact. That's like written down on the record. Yeah.
And you know, the houses have such character, don't they? And you know, they're part of the, I suppose a mixture of Georgian and Victorian.
Buildings. Yeah, they are. Yeah. So this one's probably Georgian. Well, the windows are Wyatt windows, the bottom windows.
Yeah.
Now, Peter Pearson, my friend, he's an architectural historian, among other things, artist, whatever. And he said the Wyatt windows came in 1800. So these windows were extended to take the wider window and the bottom.
Oh, I see.
Originally, they would have been all Georgian. Six lights, is it? 12 panes in them. And they were extending the little windows put on the side. And you can see it actually in the windowsill outside where it's made up of two pieces instead of one.
Yeah.
Now, there was a quarry over here, and all of the quarry, it's just a few yards over there. It's filled in now. But it was where they quarried all the stone for to build the bridge and the tower, the Guinness Bridge. You'll find in the book there's photographs of everything in it. The the bridge, all the stonework, the mills. That's the mill as it used to be. There's the bridge. That's the gatehouse of the bridge. And I was out with Peter 2 or 3 weeks back, and we were clearing out rubbish. He inherited a house in Bray, and we were clearing out rubbish out of the shed. And I came upon a pile of glass sheets, and I said, oh, gee, they're dangerous. And I was wrapping them up, and in the middle of them, I found a glass plate with a picture on it. And where was it?
Mm-hmm.
It was the bridge beyond, and the mills in the background. The very picture that would have interested only one person, and that was me. You know.
I know, but to find it like that.
It was amazing.
Yeah.
That's here. There's one like it here, but this one of the glass plate, it was down the same direction as that, only it took in the bridge.
Oh, yes.
And
I
this,
see, yes.
Yeah, it showed this very well. Yeah.
Well, again, thank you for showing that to me.
I take this.
But Hugh O'Connor, it's been an amazing story. Thank you very much for telling it to me. Thank you.
Thank you. This-